This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. On this week's program, wife inheritance in Kenya. If a woman loses her husband, she's passed along to her brother-in-law, whether she likes it or not.
They would have chased me, and since I didn't have power, there was nothing I could have done. I had to do as they said because they were the in-laws and they were in charge.
Plus, an Afghan orphan picks up the pieces of his life. And in Albania, teen tour guides blaze new trails.
We were the ones to break this unspoken ban on women going out at night. When we first started going to cafes with our tourists, the men would give us dirty looks.
Welcome to the World Vision Report. In western Kenya, the Luo tribe practices a local custom called widow inheritance. That means when a man dies, his wife is inherited by his brother, and he's obliged to take financial care of her and her children. But this age-old custom has a new and deadly twist. In a part of the world where AIDS is rampant, widow inheritance is spreading the HIV virus. Richard Locke reports from the province of Nyanza. This is the first of a two-part series on widowhood.
It's late evening on the shores of Lake Victoria. Bullfrogs and crickets fill the night air around Paris Atieno's mud house. There's only one room, lit by a single flickering kerosene lamp that casts a dull glow on the few modest items of furniture. Inside, Paris talks quietly to her 16-year-old daughter. On the floor, her two younger children sleep soundly on a mattress, protected from malaria-carrying mosquitoes by a net. Paris sits slumped in a chair with her legs tucked up. She rests her forehead on the palm of her hand. She's alarmingly thin. The skin on her face is pulled tight over her cheekbones. Paris is HIV positive. So was her husband, who died 11 years ago, a time when few in rural Kenya understood the virus.
When my husband died, it wasn't much out in the open. People could not say so much about it back then.
Paris didn't know that AIDS killed her husband. What she did know was that an age-old local custom required her to begin a sexual relationship with her dead husband's brother, regardless of whether he's married. Widow inheritance remains common among the Luo community in western Kenya. Paris would rather have remained alone. She's still grieving for her husband, but she had little choice in the matter.
They would have chased me, and since I didn't have power, there was nothing I could have done. I had to do as they said because they were the in-laws and they were in charge.
After her already married brother-in-law inherited Paris, she gave birth to a baby boy. But the young infant died, and soon after, Paris herself fell sick. She tested HIV positive, but before she could persuade her brother-in-law to take a test, he abandoned her.
If you miss me singing here, you will find me nowhere but...
Florence Gundo sits on a concrete tombstone and sings a hymn she's written about the final journey to heaven. Florence runs a local charity called the Orongo Widows and Orphans Group. Its sole purpose is to help women widowed by AIDS as well as their children.
If you miss me walking here, you will find me nowhere...
Nyanza province has one of the highest HIV rates in Kenya. It's thought one in four here are infected. Florence points to the unmarked graves that scar the open fields where goats now graze. Most people here are too poor to afford headstones. Florence says the virus has wiped out almost an entire generation here.
This place we are standing is a home of very many people. And it happened one time when everybody died in this home. There are so many graves here.
Florence explains that her society is polygamous. Men in the Luo tribe commonly have multiple wives when they inherit a sister-in-law. So the practice has fueled the spread of AIDS, as HIV-positive widows unwittingly infect numerous in-laws.
The man can go to his home, and he is going to infect his wife too.
So Florence encourages village elders to persuade people to get tested for AIDS. It's something that up until recently has been taboo. The task hasn't been easy.
No. It was very difficult. It took time.
William Guti is an elder who now works closely with Florence and counsels men and women on the importance of getting tested.
When a widow has been left behind, it is a must for her to go and have an HIV test. And any man who wants to have a relationship with her, he must also go for the test, so that they know their status.
Several widows who've come to Florence have found the courage to refuse their in-laws' demands. Some are afraid of contracting HIV from their brothers-in-law. Others are afraid of passing it on.
Clinton? Clean.
In the shade of a jacaranda tree, Betty Tom comforts her young nephew. Betty was widowed with three children at the age of 23. At the time, she knew she was HIV positive, so she refused to be inherited, although she couldn't bring herself to tell her in-laws why.
I really had it so rough. I didn't want to indulge in another affair. Maybe I could infect that person.
But her refusal came at a cost.
Reporter Richard Locke picks up Betty Tom's story in part two of this series next week.
If you miss me singing here, you will find me nowhere. But coming up to God's glory, I'll be singing up there. I'll be singing up there, hallelujah. I'll be singing up there. Coming up to God's glory, I'll be singing up there.
The AIDS pandemic has influenced artists all across the developing world. This is a song by Ugandan musician Samite. It was inspired by an experience he had as a small boy growing up in Africa. When he was 12 years old, Samite moved to the country to live with his grandparents. At around the same time, a new type of lizard made its appearance in the region. It was a brightly colored lizard, purple, red, blue, and yellow. But the lizard was very poisonous. When Samite saw one of these lizards inside his house, he climbed onto the table and called his grandfather to come and kill it. Only then did Samite feel safe. In this song, Samite calls on his grandfather to come and kill the modern-day scourge, AIDS and HIV. That was Ugandan musician Samite from his CD Mbala Sasa. Over the last few weeks, we've seen the devastation caused by the cyclone in Myanmar and the earthquake in China. Many of us remember similar images after the 2004 tsunami in Indonesia. At the time, it was difficult to imagine how the devastated villages and towns would recover. The remote town of Charlung was flattened by the giant wave, and more than 90% of the people there were killed. But one teacher from Charlung is helping to build the future for those left behind. Prue Clark brings us this story from Banda Aceh.
Di sini banyak lab, salah satunya mikrobiologi.
Neela Manies joins her microbiology class at Banda Aceh University. Her fellow veterinary students, undergraduates like her, are busy testing water samples. More than half are women, all of them dressed like Neela in colourful headscarves required of Muslim women in Aceh province. 3 years ago, Neela was a high school senior in the town of Charlung, a small coastal village a day's drive away. The people had little. They farmed and rarely left the village. Neela had never been anywhere else. She says all of that changed one day in December 2004.
Pas pagi, kita emang enggak terpikir akan terjadi tsunami.
When the tsunami came, it was Sunday morning. I was still having breakfast with mother, sister, and brother. Suddenly, the earth started shaking badly. We were confused. After a few minutes, we heard people saying, "The ocean is coming, the ocean is coming." And we all started running.
Neela ran to higher ground, but most of her family stayed behind.
My mother waited for my sister, and my sister waited for her husband, but the water would not wait.
All of Neela's family, except for one brother, were washed away. Of the 4,000 people in Charlung, only 300 survived.
I didn't know if there's another life after this, or if this is the end of the world.
But after a few months, someone started making plans for Chalung's children. Danny Fauzan is a young volunteer with Rotary International. Danny spends much of his time now at the regional airport, flying around the province, overseeing aid projects in villages like Chalung. Danny's one of several people who've helped Neela get to college, but the story begins with a schoolteacher named Ibu Dina. Ibu Dina still lives in Chalung, but the roads are so badly damaged we couldn't reach her. So Danny relates her story.
At that time of the tragedies, Ibu Dina was actually out of town to attend this wedding ceremony. So she left all of her kids, three of them, at house in Chalung.
Ibu Dina never found her children's bodies. Amidst her grief, says Danny, Ibu Dina saw that Chalung's children were drowning in their own sadness. She decided she must get some of them back to school and give them a sense of purpose. She set up a makeshift classroom in the barracks where the survivors were staying. No one from Chalung had ever been to college. It seemed unlikely these students could be the first to go. But Ibu Dina tutored a handful of them, and five high school seniors, Neela and four boys, passed the National University entrance exams.
You can imagine that studying in the barracks and all of these difficulties, and still they managed to get accepted.
Ibu Dina's next challenge was finding money to pay for college. She went to every aid group and even the Indonesian government, but Rotary International was the quickest to offer Chalung students some help.
They can be a really good model for this, all the young people there, to see, you know, it's possible that someone from the place where you grew up is also getting to university. They can be a really a living case of a hopes. Yeah.
Back in the city of Banda Aceh, Neela and three other girls prepare dinner. Neela's keen to practice her new English skills. She shows me her room and introduces her roommate, a student from another part of Aceh.
My friend.
Hello.
Hello. My name is Novi.
Is she good to live with?
Yes. Dia kaka.
She is like my sister.
Living in the house, says Neela, has helped ease her grief.
It's almost like a family. All of my friends are students who lost their family. It really helps to stay with them, to share with people who went through what I went through.
Neela's made the day-long journey back to Chalung only once. The sight of the destroyed town still overwhelmed her.
It was terrible. The village was totally different from before. I couldn't stop crying, so I don't like to go back. The memories are still too painful for me.
Neela and three of the boys watch the sun go down over Aceh from the porch of their home. The boys are studying geology, agriculture, social work, gaining skills they say will be a great help to their people.
When you finish, do you want to go back to Chalung?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Why?
22-year-old Molly says he wants to help rebuild his village. The memory of his family, he says, will motivate him to make Chalung better than ever. For the World Vision Report, I'm Prue Clark in Banda Aceh, Indonesia.
Albania used to be one of the most isolated countries in the world, but not anymore. After the communist government fell in 1992, visitors started to trickle into the country. A group of Albanian teenagers decided to capitalize on the new interest in their country, and they came up with a plan that would not only help the struggling economy, but provide them much-needed jobs. Megan Williams reports.
It's bumpy going on the main road leading from Albania's airport. Potholes and construction, signs of the country's past and future, slow the ride down. Ariona Shahini is one of my guides for the weekend. She's the leader of a small and unusual tourist venture. To begin with, its guides all live in Bathore, an area on the outskirts of Tirana. Like Ariona, the other Bathore guides are all in their late teens or 20s. With playful irony, they call themselves the Bathore Beach Kids, despite the fact there's no beach here, not even a pond. They call what they do responsible tourism. They make sure their guests enjoy Albania's cafes and cultural spots. But they also take tourists on some distinctly untraditional tourist stops, walks through struggling neighborhoods, dropping in on traditional weddings, and visits with local families. Their goal is to give visitors a positive but realistic view of the country. For a mere $50 a day, tourists get food, lodging, and a close-up view of Albania. So we're here. It's kind of a muddy little side road. Today we're having lunch at the home of Lina and Lanti Andrei Papai, the parents of one of the Bothore kids.
Buongiorno.
It's a modest bungalow with a yard that holds a small vineyard and some fruit trees. I sit down with the Andrei Papais in their neat, colorfully decorated living room to a lunch of stuffed eggplant, a cheese and onion pastry, and homemade bread.
This looks fantastic. There's a lovely salad with feta. Questo è formaggio feta.
The Andrei Papais tell me, so far, they've hosted more than a dozen groups of tourists. They say the money helps, but after having grown up in an Albania cut off from the outside world, the chance to make ties with foreigners is the biggest pleasure. We become like family, says Mr. Andre Pepai. So at the end, it's always difficult to part ways. After lunch, my tour of the neighborhood begins. My guide is Bucheria Imerai, a bright, pixie-ish 17-year-old. We wind our way through unpaved streets lined with half-finished cinder block houses. Jagged mountains loom in the distance. She's taken dozens of tourists, mostly from nearby Italy, on this route. Bucheria says she's putting some of the money she's earned towards her education. But her earnings also mean she can make her future here in Albania. Because of high unemployment, it's something her older siblings and so many other young people here have been unable to do.
Diciamo che la vita qui delle famiglie sarebbe stata molto difficile.
If my siblings hadn't gone abroad, our family life would have been much harder. They've helped us economically. The negative is that if everyone keeps leaving Albania, when will we build its future?
The last stop in our busy day is a cup of tea at a local cafe. As the kids and I make our way along the main road, group leader Eriona Shahini tells me that the tour guides have been trailblazers here.
We were the ones to break this unspoken ban on women going out at night. When we first started going to cafes with our tourists, the men would give us dirty looks. Women just aren't supposed to be out at night.
As the Bathory Beach kids help change local attitudes, they also hope to have the chance to show off Albania to a wider cross-section of tourists. For the World Vision Report, I'm Megan Williams in Bathory, Albania.
The Afghan province of Bamiyan is best known as the place where the Taliban destroyed two ancient statues of Buddha. But it's also the place where the ethnic Hazara people live, and the Taliban made life very difficult for them. Reporter Will Everett met a young Hazara boy in an orphanage there. His name is Zahir. This is his story in his own words.
Hello, my name is Zahir. I am 12 years old. I have been in this orphanage for 2 years. When I was a small child, I lost my dad. The Taliban came into our house and took my dad with them. They took him out in the front of the Buddha statue, and then they killed him. It was a month before we found his dead body. We took the body and buried it in a place called Hyderabad. After that, we decided to go to a safe place. We walked for a long time to a place called Besud. It was a long way walking and crossing with tall mountains full of snow, but we made it. In Besud, we had to work hard. After being in Besud for a while, we went to Ghazni province. We rented a small pushcart and started working in the streets of Ghazni. We earned about $2 a day. My mom did people's laundry while we were in Ghazni. But one day, while she was washing clothes down at the river, she was swept away. No one was there to save her. After the fall of Taliban, we returned to our hometown of Bamiyan. Now, my uncle has a new shop, and I live with him.
That was a young Zaharan orphan named Zahir. He told a story to reporter Will Everett. Scott Neeson was a high-flying Hollywood insider. He headed up international marketing for 20th Century Fox, and he hung out with people most of us only see on the screen. Then he took a trip to Asia. It was a vacation, a chance to relax and recharge and have some fun. But a tour through the massive garbage dumps of Phnom Penh in Cambodia changed all that.
I was taken down there by a local, and it was just quite mind-blowing. Just this vast 11-acre site of garbage, and there's children everywhere. They live in the garbage dump and they work every day picking through recyclables. And it is shocking. It's as close to an apocalypse as I'd ever want to see.
So what did you do?
At that moment, I took two children out of the dump. I found their parents, talked to them, and those two children started in school. And the lesson there, and I think it was an important lesson for me, was that such a small part of my income changed these children's lives profoundly.
And then you had to go back to this big new job you had taken on with Sony Pictures, back to L.A. What a contrast.
It was, actually. And when I got back, I just couldn't get it out of my mind. Not only the visual and the olfactory of the garbage dump, but also how excessive the life was that I was leading.
What was your life like in Hollywood? Can you draw us a picture of that?
I was single, had a very nice house, had a Porsche, very nice yacht in the marina. And then there was the premieres, the Academy Awards, and lots of international travel.
A lot of people's dream life.
Yes, and that was one of the issues, actually. When you're surrounded by people who are telling you what a wonderful life you have, you are so lucky, and you have hundreds of people wanting that job that you have, you do believe it. And it takes a lot to be able to break out of that.
So what did you do? Let's get back on that track. You got back into that Hollywood life you were in, and you couldn't forget about what you'd seen in Phnom Penh.
Yes. Well, before I left Phnom Penh, I had a bigger plan, and it was quite simple, to bring children out of the dump and put them into school. But I was 44, 45, and I'd been in the business 25 years. So I made a commitment to myself. I would stick out this job for 1 year and see how I felt. If I still had the same passion to help and to serve the children, then I would move there. And within that 12-month period, I'd gone back to Cambodia every month for periods between 2 days and 7 days.
Every month?
Yeah, it's quite a trip too.
Why did you go back every month? What were you doing?
Each time I went back there was another step forward, and each step was exponentially bigger, bringing in the number of children, setting up an education program. And I think the biggest step forward was when I took a lease on a building, and that's where there was a tangible point where the Cambodian Children's Fund first started.
So you were going back and forth every month, and then something happened in your work that kind of flipped the switch for you. What happened?
I was in Phnom Penh, and I was there. I had 11 or so children who had started at CCF, and there was typhoid amongst at least 5 or 6 of them. And it was something I had no idea how to deal with, what the resources were, and I hadn't had children of my own, so it was quite a dramatic experience. And during this, I had a phone call from a very major star and the star's agent. They were quite infuriated because their private jet didn't have the amenities they wanted on board. And the star was refusing to get on the private jet, which was costing a massive amount of money.
Why did they call you in Cambodia?
I was then head of marketing, and that covers the publicity with the actors. And this actor was high enough up and meaningful enough to warrant going straight to me. And I couldn't imagine two more extremes. These children from the garbage dump who were suffering typhoid and an actor who would not get on a private jet because, you know, his amenities weren't there. And it's hard to ignore that sign, a sign that I needed to change. And this was as obvious as it could get.
You just right there that day after that call made a decision to switch completely and move to Cambodia?
Yes, I resigned from my job. It was exactly 12 months to the day. And in December of 2004, I moved to Phnom Penh. I've been living there now for nearly 3 years, and it's a very difficult life.
What makes it difficult?
There is an awful lot of suffering there. It's a country that's still recovering from many, many years of civil war, that's recovering from the Holocaust of Pol Pot, when one third or so of the population was wiped out. And there's a large percentage of child prostitution, there's a very high domestic abuse rate, and there's a general cultural acceptance to it, which I had trouble coping with initially.
Mm-hmm. And what is your organization doing now, Scott, on the ground to work against that?
We now have 270 children, of which about 180 are from the garbage dump. I would immodestly say it's the highest quality program, I think, of any non-profit in Cambodia. We offer private school level education in both Cambodian reading and writing. The core subjects are computer and English, which starts to fold into a vocational program. We also have health facilities in all of the residential areas, and we have a general support group. These children have it inside them. They just need an opportunity.
What is it like for you living there, knowing there are all these kids still on the dump, and you can only take out one at a time, maybe two at a time, and there's still so much need?
Even though we're at capacity and we cannot take more children in, I still like to be at the dump to take care of the children that are there and their parents and do what I can. I think probably one of the most touching moments was down the garbage dump and all the horror and all the misery. And I squatted down for a few minutes, and this young boy, who was about 7, had been picking through garbage. He came walking up and he sat down on my leg, put his arm around me, sighed, and just sat there for 3 or 4 minutes while he rested. And without a word, he got up and started working again. And it literally moved me to tears, and I didn't do that very often.
Mm. Looking back at what a dramatic shift and change your life took from just taking a vacation to Cambodia, how would you describe your life now?
Well, that's a really good question. People have an assumption that it's a happier life, and people say you must sleep well at night, and that's really not true. You do see an enormous amount of despair and just general tragedy. But the part of me that was empty, that was hollow, is now very full. And I work harder than I've ever worked. I no longer get a salary. But the peace that's now filled changes everything.
All right. Scott Neeson, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Scott Neeson is the founder and executive director of the Cambodian Children's Fund. He spoke to us on a recent trip back to Los Angeles. And that brings us to the end of our show today. You can find us on the web at worldvisionreport.org. You can sign up for a podcast there, see photographs, or even listen to the show. I'm Peggy Waymire. Join me again next week for another World Vision Report.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.